Shoreshin Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Well, greetings again, everybody. This is Bill, and this is our tour portion on Vayera, and he appeared. And this is taken from Genesis or Breshit, chapter 18, verse 1 through chapter 22, verse 24. Now, traditionally, this particular portion begins on the third day after Abraham and his entire household had been circumcised. And so the point would be that even though he's enduring this pain of circumcision, Abraham is the congenial host. And it's interesting that this appearance by the Lord is on the third day after this covenant has been ratified. In Abraham, we see someone who exhibits the traits that the seed of Abraham is to emulate. He cares for strangers. In Deuteronomy 10, verse 19, we're told that you are therefore to love the stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. And during the meal, we see that Abraham is the one who stands ready to attend to all their needs, and he doesn't partake of the meal himself. And so he demonstrates that to be considered a leader, you must first be a servant. Of course, Yeshua speaks to this issue after washing the feet of the disciples. In John chapter 13, he says, "You call me teacher and Lord, and you say well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that you should do as I have done to you. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who is sent greater than he who has sent him." And so Abraham serves as this great example of what Yeshua was calling for in his disciples, and that is to be the person who has a heart to serve, to have the heart of a servant. And if you do that, then your master will be motivated to hearken unto you. Now, in sharp contrast to that example is the terrible example set by Sodom and the cities of the plain, or Sodom. Because not only are they engaging in debauchery and activities that birth the word sodomy, for instance, but it is written that their greater sin is their neglect of strangers and those in need, because they desired to maintain their own property and only accepting those who they considered to be prosperous. Now, if you consider as wicked as Egypt was, When Israel left Egypt, Egyptian cities still stood. And as wicked as the Canaanites were, they were permitted to be in the land with Abraham. But Sodom and the cities of the plain were completely overturned, and the entire region to this day is still uninhabitable. So it is taught that the perversity of Sodom was the byproduct of their disdain for the stranger. So in short, their greed and their self-indulgence fostered the behavior that is associated with Sodom. In other words, the things that most people associate with Sodom, that is sodomy, homosexuality, is an offshoot of the greed and the self-indulgence. Now in chapter 18, verse 1, it says, "And the Lord appeared to him, Vayera, as he sat in the tent door in the heat of the day." Now, there's already been one occasion before where the Lord has appeared to Abraham, and this all happens in the land of Israel. And so he appeared unto him, and then in verse 2 it says that three men stood over against him, and these men were in the guise of angels. And he runs to meet them and invite them to a meal. And in verse 3 he says, "My Lord, if I have found favor in your sight." And when he says, "My Lord," the Hebrew term is not Adoni, which you would expect it to be. But the Hebrew term is Adonai, and Adonai is a term that is typically reserved for God, for the Creator. Now, the Midrash teaches that this particular meeting occurred on what would become Pesach, or Passover. Consider some of these points. The one who has assimilated into corrupt culture, and the one who was corrupted by it, is going to be delivered from it. Of course, we're talking about Lot, who is living in Sodom. Abraham washes their feet and invites them to recline, which is one of the aspects we see of the Pesach Seder, in the Seder of the Messiah with his disciples. He washed their feet. In this story, bread is made very quickly. And the hint is that it's unleavened bread. And so this bread is made very quickly for them. Three cakes, as a matter of fact, corresponding to the three matzot on the Pesach Seder. When they appeared a lot later on in Genesis 19, he makes them unleavened bread. And of course, the main thing that is told to Abraham in the door of his tent is that you're going to have a son. And so the promise of a son who will propagate the covenant is made here. Of course, the story of the Passover is about the redemption of the firstborn. And so there are all these particular points in the story in Genesis 18 that parallels in some way the things that we see in the story of the Passover. Now, verse 7, it says that Abraham takes a calf from the herd and he gives it to the servant, or literally the youth, and some people have interpreted that to mean that this was Ishmael. But at any rate, he, in verse 8, he takes the curd, the milk, and the calf and set it before them. Now, Judaism teaches that he first gave them the dairy to quench their thirst. And then following this, he gave them the actual meal of meat and bread. So in other words, Judaism concludes that Abraham was faithful to the dietary laws and not mixing meat and dairy. However, my opinion is that meat and dairy aren't forbidden by the Torah anyway. That's my opinion. But nonetheless, we see him serving dairy along with meat. Now, this is the only place in the Torah where supernatural beings are described as partaking of food. Now, Yeshua, after the resurrection, prepares food for his disciples and presumably eats of it, even though it doesn't say specifically that he does, and that's in John chapter 21. But here we see that these angels, or these supernatural beings, are actually eating food. Now, in verse 10, the Lord is speaking now, and he says, "I will certainly return to you this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son." And of course, Sarah, who was listening at the door of the tent, laughed. Vayitzak, verse 12, which is the word from which we get the name Yitzak. But when she laughs, the Lord asks, "Is anything too hard for the Lord?" in verse 14. Literally, he says, "Is anything too wonderful for the Lord?" And the root word there is pala, from which we get phele. And it's the same word that is used when he is called counselor, wonderful. The government is upon his shoulders, etc. So that's the same word. But is anything too wonderful or too hard that the Lord can't accomplish it? And of course, this is said in regard to Isaac, who is the promised seed. Now, I think it's important to recognize that Sarah's hesitancy is because she believes it's going to require a miracle equivalent to the resurrection from the dead, because she considers herself so old, far beyond the years to give birth, dead, if you will, and in that sense. And so it's going to require the resurrection from the dead. And so that's the only way for the promised seed to fulfill God's purposes. And keep it in mind that it is believed that all this is going on at the season that would later become Passover. Now, verse 17, the Lord says, "Shall I hide from Abraham that which I am doing?" He considers his servant because he is to become a mighty nation. He is to be a blessing to all the nations. And in verse 19, he says this, "And he will command his children and household to keep the way of the Lord." And so for all of these reasons, he says, "Now shall I hide from Abraham that which I am doing, considering all of these things about my servant?" And of course, he concludes that he's not going to hide it from him. But in verse 19, let's go back to that very quickly. The Lord acknowledges in Abraham that he will command his children and his household to keep the way of the Lord. And so the greatest gift that a father can give is to teach his children to do what is right. And the Lord says of him, "Because I have known," and that he will do this, because he will do this, that is why he will be a great nation. And when it says that I have known that he's going to do this, it refers to knowledge, firsthand knowledge, but that word can also be translated as love. In other words, what it seems to be saying is that God has firsthand knowledge, very intimate knowledge, that Abraham will do what is right, and he will teach his children what is right. God knows that He will teach His household righteousness and justice. And therefore, God concludes He will not keep what He's about to do from Abraham, because, actually, Abraham has a part in the plan. In verse 20, it says, "The cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and their sin is grievous." And that means either that the wicked are articulating these things that are so wicked, or the cries of those that they oppress have become so great. Now, that's not too far-fetched, because in Ezekiel chapter 16, we read, it says, "Look, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughter had pride, fullness of food, and abundance of idleness. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy. And they were haughty and committed abomination before me. Therefore, I took them away as I saw fit." So, the Creator determines that He's going to destroy these cities. And from here to the end of the chapter, Abraham begins to intercede on behalf of these cities. And in this, we see Abraham's compassion, and we see God's willingness to hearken to His servant Abraham, because God does not take glee in the pending destruction of the wicked. Abraham doesn't either, but that's not God's heart, to rejoice in the destruction of the wicked. In Luke chapter 9, beginning at verse 51, it says, "Now it came to pass, when the time had come for him to be received up, that is Yeshua, that he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, and sent messengers before his face. And as they went, they entered a village of the Samaritans to prepare for him. But they did not receive him, because his face was set for the journey to Jerusalem. And when his disciples, James and John, saw this, they said, 'Lord, do you want us to command fire to come down from heaven and consume them, just as Elijah did?' But he turned and rebuked them, and said, 'You do not know what manner of spirit you are of. For the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them.'" And so what we see in this is Abraham does not hold contempt for these evildoers. He has compassion for them. But likewise, we see that God, His purpose is not to destroy people, but to save them. So Abraham is one who does not hold contempt for evildoers. He wants them to repent. And in this exchange, his apparent logic was, if there were a group of righteous people in amongst these wicked, then if they are upright, then they might affect these wicked people in the positive sense, provoking them to repent. See, in our day, it would be easy for us to harbor contempt and derision for wicked people because of all the wicked things that they do. Yet, like Abraham, we should despise the actions without hating the person, because we know that God is always ready to pardon sin. "As I live, says the Lord God, I have no pleasure in the death of the wicked, but that the wicked turn from his way and live. Turn, turn from your evil ways," according to Ezekiel chapter 33. In this exchange, we also see Abraham's emphasis on justice. He says to the Creator, "Will you destroy the righteous with the wicked?" Now, it may be, that Abraham is mainly concerned for Lot, because, as it turns out, Lot is the only one deserving of deliverance. It could be argued that, even then, even though he is delivered, his deliverance is not due to his own righteousness, but is due to Abraham and his righteousness. But nevertheless, in verse 25, Abraham kind of pushes the point. He says, "Far be it from you to slay the righteous with the wicked, that the righteous should be as the wicked. Shall not the judge of all the earth do justly?" Justice is the basis of all virtue. Anything that may be considered loftier than justice, nevertheless, must still be based on justice. So Abraham acknowledged that he was quite forward to take this up with God, but nevertheless, he is pushing the point of, is it right to destroy the righteous along with the wicked? Now, during this entire dialogue, God knew that there weren't 10 righteous in the entire city. He knew that. In fact, had everyone left with Lot that was there, that the record seems to bear out, there would have been at least 8 people, Lot and his wife, his two unmarried daughters, and there were at least two married daughters, it seems, with sons-in-law. And so if they had all left, there would have been eight. And even if all of them had left, not all of them, I don't think, would be considered righteous necessarily. In other words, all through this dialogue, when Abraham is saying, if there are 50, if there are 40, if there are 30, what have you, all the way down to 10, God already knew there was not 10. He knew that. And so perhaps part of this is to see what's in Abraham. Is Abraham compassionate? Is Abraham willing to plead on their behalf, to intercede on their behalf? Or at the very least, is he willing to go and plead on behalf of Lot? But again, even if everybody that was with Lot had left, it looks like there would have been maybe eight people. And most of them wouldn't be considered righteous at all. In fact, we remember from a previous Torah portion that Noah is called righteous, but his sons and family weren't called that, not necessarily. And so seemingly they were spared because of Noah's righteousness. So likewise, Lot's family and even Lot himself seems to be spared because of Abraham's righteousness. Again, we're reminded of Passover because it was the father's obedience at Passover that saved the firstborn son, not the actions of the firstborn son. So perhaps, again, this entire conversation is to bring to the surface what was in Abraham's heart. And consequently, the narrative serves to show what you and I are to strive for. If we are to be the sons and daughters of Abraham, the seed of Abraham, we must do the works of Abraham, according to John 8. Now, as soon as Abraham quits speaking, the Lord leaves to investigate the cities. And so we come into chapter 19. And in recording about what happened to the cities of the plain, Peter, in his second epistle, says in verse 8 of chapter 2, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, he condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds. Now, how is it that a man who chose to live among the wicked in order to profit is considered righteous? Even though the inhabitants of Sodom wanted to assault the men who appeared to Lot, Lot protected them. So apparently, being associated with Abraham had affected him in a way that there remained virtue within him, even though Sodom had affected him as well. But he put his life in peril when he took these men in. But yet, he turns right around and he offers his two unmarried daughters. In verse 1, it says that the two angels came to Sodom at evening, or at Erev, finding Lot at the gate of the city. Of course, this is where the people would often congregate in those days. And Lot, upon seeing them, bows down before them to serve them, just as Abraham had done. In verse 2, he invites them into his house to wash, to sleep, and to depart early in the morning. Now, compare that he lived in a house in a city to the fact that Abraham dwelt in a tent in the countryside. Because going back again to earlier Torah portions, the first recorded city builder was Cain, who was a rebel, followed by Nimrod, who was a rebel. And so it would seem that cities have always attracted these less than virtuous and unsavory characters and personalities that bring with them all this unsightly behavior and iniquity and transgression, etc. Now, these men had determined, but really angels, had determined to stay in the square of the city where travelers apparently would stay. But that would accentuate the fact that Sodom was an inhospitable city. So knowing this, Lot urges them to come into his house. And in verse 3, it says, he made them a feast and made them unleavened bread, again hinting at Pesach. In fact, tradition says that the date of this event was the 15th day of Aviv, which is the first day of unleavened bread. Remember, Sarah made three loaves quickly in Genesis 18. But in verse 4, it says, but before they lay down, the men of the city compassed the house round about. And it says that they came from every age group and every district of the city, because the news of these travelers came very quickly. And obviously they had been observed by informants who went and let these people know. And so the word spread. And all these different people came to the house of Luck. And apparently every one of them were addicted to the particular lifestyle for which they were infamous. And this is why, obviously, there were not 10 righteous in order to spare the city. Now, in verse 5, it says that they desired to know them, which is to say they desired to sodomize them. And in verses 6 through 8, Lot compels them not to do this and actually puts his life on the line. But yet, as we already pointed out, he turns right around and he offers them his virgin daughters to do what they will with, which is unbelievable. Yet he seeks to spare men who have come under the shadow of my roof, because that's his sacred duty to take care of these travelers who are in his house. Now, these two daughters that he offers to these men are presumably the ones that he is later going to cohabitate with. In verse 9, the men acknowledge that Lot is a sojourner, and yet here's this sojourner wanting to tell us what to do. And so they attacked Lot, and as they attacked him, apparently they pressed him back against the closed door. And in verses 10 and 11, this is when the angels open the door, rescue Lot from the mob, and then smite them with a temporary blindness. But even while they're blind, they're trying to grope for the door to get to these men. Now, verses 12 and 13, the angels speak to Lot, and they tell him, "Whoever you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we will destroy it." And Lot's entire household is given the opportunity to be rescued. But his sons-in-law don't believe his warning. They think he's joking around, think that he's just being a jester of some type, because they can detect no reason why the city would be overturned. They can't see any way that what Lot is saying is going to happen. Just like people who were on the unsinkable Titanic could not fathom any scenario whereby the ship would sink, and yet the unsinkable ship sunk. So consequently, because they think he's joking around, both they and his married daughters are doomed. In verse 15, the angels tell him, "Take your wife and the two daughters that are here, lest you be swept away." Again, he's being compelled to leave, and the angels are offering deliverance to those who are still with him. But unbelievably, Lot is very slow to leave. In fact, the angels had to grab him and make him go. And why was this done? According to verse 16, because the Lord was being merciful unto him. Now, even though Abraham's righteousness benefits Lot, because they are there to deliver Lot, nevertheless, Lot still had the responsibility to take action. And so this makes it clear, as far as I'm concerned, that Lot was spiritually weak and very slow to do the right thing. He was, if you will, hesitant to get into the lifeboat and escape the sinking ship. See, righteous people are saved miraculously, even while everything falls around them. For example, Noah. Everything was chaotic around him, but he is safe and sound. The congregation of Philadelphia is promised protection in the midst of their great trial that's related to us in Revelation 3:10. "Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep or guard you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth." But the less righteous have an opportunity to escape. But if they refuse to heed the warnings, they will be swept away with the wicked. Luke chapter 21, verse 20. "But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." So again, Abraham's righteousness is why Lot is given the opportunity to escape. Noah's righteousness gave opportunity for his entire family to be spared, even as the destruction is going on around them. But Lot's righteousness, because it doesn't match that of a Noah or an Abraham, is allowed to escape, but yet it's up to him to act. And if he doesn't act, then he's going to be swept away with the wicked. Now, the one thing we can say about Lot is from Lot is going to come Ruth, who is the ancestress, of course, of King David. But nevertheless, he still has to act. He has a responsibility. In Genesis 19, verse 17, here's what the angels say. Escape for your life. Do not look behind you nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. Had he not fled, he would have been destroyed. And yet the angel says, when Lot asks him, can I go to this little town over here? Because I don't have time to get to the mountains. The angel says, hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. And so Lot first escaped to Zoar, the smaller of the five cities. And apparently from there, he witnessed the destruction. The righteous witness the destruction at times, but from a safe distance. In this particular case, God rained sulfur and fire upon the cities. Perhaps it was generated by a big seismic upheaval. And presumably, this is what provoked Lot's wife to turn back and to watch the destruction. Now, why she looked back is speculative. Nobody knows for sure, but in the end, what we understand is it cost her her life, and she became a pillar of salt. Because she looked back and lingered, apparently the salt from the upheaval and from the disruption in the sea, this salt and this saline solution enveloped her, and obviously it would have suffocated her. But it apparently also preserved her body for some time. Josephus records that he saw it in his day. But the point is this, looking back and lingering, she is looking back at something that is doomed for destruction as if to say that's where her heart still is, and she's very slow to leave it. And so Yeshua cautions us about looking back and lingering in Luke 17. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. In that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. Likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Whoever seeks to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life will preserve it. See, Abram was told to leave country, kindred, and father's house, not just physically. He was not to leave his heart there either, but to separate completely from those things. So perhaps Lot's wife's heart was in Sodom, and this is what caused her to turn back. Now, verse 27 and 8, Abraham didn't know what the outcome was going to be from the conversation that had taken place with the angels, but that morning he arose very early to see what the outcome was, and of course, what he saw was the land was smoking like a furnace. And in verse 29, it makes it clear that Lot was spared, not because of Lot, but because God remembered Abraham. Now, verse 30, Lot fears that Zoar is going to be destroyed as well, and he flees to a cave with his daughters. And it would seem that Zoar was indeed destroyed after Lot's departure. Now, when this happened, the two daughters believe that they are the only remaining human beings, in spite of just leaving the city. But nonetheless, they believe that the destruction is universal. And if it is universal from their point of view, then they feel that they must continue the human race. Now, if not, if they don't believe the destruction is universal, then perhaps they're just a product of their environment. And by that I mean Sodom. And these are the ones that Lot had offered to the men of Sodom. But at any rate, in verse 32 and 3, they made Lot to drink wine to the point of intoxication. And on the first night, of course, we're told that the eldest lay with him and the younger followed on the next night. And it says in both cases that he didn't know when they came in or when they left. But when they were pregnant, he knew. He must have known what happened. So if you consider that they got him intoxicated the first time and he didn't know what was going on, he must have allowed himself to be intoxicated the second time. And I say that because it is reminiscent of Noah soon after he departs the ark and all the destruction that he's just witnessed. He allowed himself to get intoxicated. And of course, that ended up somebody being cursed. Now, rabbinical commentary takes note of the relative ease with which these two women conceived compared to the struggle to conceive endured by Sarah and Rebecca and by Rachel. And so this dichotomy is compared to the ease of weeds and thorns and how they grow and the struggle that wheat has to grow. Kind of interesting. The result of this union is Moav and Ben-Ami, or Ammon. And Moav means from father. Ben-Ami is son of my people. But both of these are going to be thorns in the flesh. And so, again, when you compare how difficult it was for Sarah, Rebecca, and Rachel to conceive and to produce wheat, if you will, with the ease that these two daughters had of conceiving and producing these thorns in the flesh of Israel, it's just a very interesting thing to comprehend or to consider. Now, in chapter 20, soon after this, for some reason, Abraham decides to journey to Gerar, and there he again presents Sarah as being his sister. Now, there is no reason to conclude that Sarah was agreeable to this, considering her prior experience. But nevertheless, Abimelech took Sarah, suggesting yet another abduction, and brought her into his harem. And again, we see that God interferes and prevents him from sinning against me, as it says in verse 6. Now, Abimelech cites ignorance in order to justify his deed, but still, it would have turned out bad for him and had he followed through with his plan. Now, it occurs to me, in this situation and in the previous situation in Egypt, that God protects his chosen, in this case, Abraham and Sarah, even when they make bad choices. It seems to me that at times he sets up, or at least tries, to set up a roadblock to prevent his chosen from doing something that's going to create a disaster. Because he intervened in the situation in Egypt, he intervenes here once again. And in verse 7, he speaks to Abimelech and he says, "Restore the man's wife, for he is a prophet. He shall pray for you, and you shall live." So even though Abraham is a prophet, he's still got this problem of being concerned about self-preservation. But nevertheless, God protects him in a way. He sets up a roadblock and does not permit this disaster to occur, and even refers to him as being a prophet. And so if you acknowledge this and let him pray for you, you'll live. So that's interesting. Number two, this is the first time the word prophet is used in Scripture. And so when most people think of a prophet, they think of a Zechariah or a Jeremiah or an Isaiah or somebody who's predicting the future. But what we see in this is a prophet is not necessarily someone who predicts the future. A biblical prophet is someone who directs people back to God and to his instructions. In verse 9, it says that Abimelech confronts Abraham, asking him, "Why did you bring this great sin on me?" Because ultimately, it is Abraham who put Abimelech in the position of potentially committing this sin. Now, Abraham attempts to justify his deceit by arguing that, well, they didn't fear God, and she really is my sister or a relative. And most commentators believe that Sarah was Abraham's niece. She was the daughter of his dead brother, Haran. In other words, she was Terah's granddaughter. But nevertheless, even though they are technically related, the bottom line is Abraham did not tell the whole truth. And so once again, he has put Sarah in peril. Again, because he was concerned for his own life. Anyway, in the end, Abimelech showers Abraham with gifts, and he invites him to sojourn there. which is in sharp contrast to Pharaoh's reaction, who made them leave. In fact, in verse 16, he speaks to Sarah, Abimelech speaks to Sarah, that is, and says, I have given your brother 1,000 pieces of silver as an eye covering for you. In other words, I've given him this 1,000 pieces of silver to make people blind to the wrong that was done to you, to make you blind to it. So it's a way of saying, so that everything will be okay. Now in chapter 21, we see that at the age of 90, Sarah finally bears a son for Abraham, who is 100. And as I've already mentioned in the previous Torah portion, these two ages or values, 90 and 100, if we take the equivalent Hebrew letters, Kuf and Zadi, they form the word Ketz or Katz, which means at the end. And so toward the end of their life, the promised seed is born. And I think that's prophetically significant. Now, verse 2, it says, And Sarah conceived and bore Abraham a son at the set time. And the Hebrew word that is translated set time here is moed. And moed, of course, is the word that's used most of the time for the appointed feast. And as it is, traditionally, Isaac was born on a moed, on an appointed feast. That is, the first day of unleavened bread, the 15th day of Aviv. Because Isaac is destined to ascend the mountain to be a living sacrifice. Now Abraham gives him the name that he was commanded to, that is Yitzhak, Isaac, from Zachak, laughter. In verse 4 it says that Abraham circumcised his son Isaac when he was 8 days old as commanded. And as far as I can detect, Isaac is the first person to be circumcised on the 8th day, which is very interesting because he is the promised seed. Now that would have been on the 8th day, or the concluding day of unleavened bread. Now keeping in mind that he's circumcised on the 8th day before the Torah is ever codified at Mount Sinai. Once again, evidence of the fact that the Torah didn't begin at Sinai. The Torah has always been, and if it's always been, it always will be. In verse 8, it says that Abraham made a great feast on the day that Isaac was weaned, and we presume that this would have been when he was about 2 to 3 years old. Now, rabbis say that it's called a great feast because of the great men who were in attendance. These would include Abimelech, Shem, and some others. That's tradition. That doesn't say that in the Bible. It just says that he made a great feast. But it was at this feast that Sarah observed Ishmael, the son of Hagar the Egyptian, mocking, making sport. So now Ishmael, who is the father of the Arab peoples, is the son of an Egyptian mother. And so the Arab peoples we see are related to the Egyptians through Hagar. But at any rate, the word that is translated mocking or making sport is mitzachek, which is from the verb or the same root as the name Isaac, Zachak, which is kind of interesting. And this word mitzachek is used many times to denote an action of impurity, idolatry, making sport in a very negative way. So obviously Ishmael wasn't laughing at Isaac in the same way that Abraham and Sarah were. There's something that happened that Sarah felt that there was something sinister in his sporting. There was something that would be a threat to Isaac's physical health, spiritual health, maybe both. Perhaps she felt that what Ishmael was doing was representative of Hagar's attitude. There's probably this animosity between the two of them, which would infer then that Ishmael was more influenced by Hagar than he was by Abraham. But at any rate, there was something that compelled Sarah to want to move him and his mother out of the camp. In fact, it is believed that Ishmael had already become very corrupt by this time, and if he stayed, he would be a corrupting influence on Isaac. In the end, Abraham is faced with another great test. He has to tell Hagar, his concubine, and he has to tell his son Ishmael to go. Now, Is it possible that he's faced with this test because before he had imperiled Sarah? And now he must show and he must exhibit that he prefers her over himself by sending Hagar and Ishmael away. She comes to him in verse 10 and says, "Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for her son shall not be heir with my son," suggesting that Ishmael and Hagar still had designs on inheriting from Abraham. Now, it's already been shown in Abraham's life that wheat and tares cannot coexist. Lot's separation from Abraham is an example of that. And yet, we see that it was very grievous to Abraham on account of his son. And either that means that he was grieved over Ishmael's actions, or he was grieved over the fact that he would have to send them away, or both. Yet, God tells Abraham, "Hearken unto your wife's voice. Listen to what Sarah's saying and follow through with it." Verse 12, because it says, "For in Isaac shall your seed be called, not Ishmael, and not later on down the road, Esau, but in Isaac." Again, there is only one seed of Abraham according to Galatians 3:16. It is not the physical seed of Abraham, Ishmael, because he was the seed in the physical sense. But that's not what God was referring to. It's the promised seed, Isaac. It's the son of promise that will propagate this covenant. Yet, even though he's going to have to send him away, God promised to make a great nation of Ishmael because he was from Abraham. But once again, we see that once Abraham has heard from God, he immediately complies, sending them both away. And this, as far as I'm concerned, distinguishes Abraham from other servants. He obeyed without delay. So we read that Hagar and Ishmael strayed in the wilderness until they had run out of water. But once again, Hagar is delivered by God, as is Ishmael, because at one point God opens her eyes, allowing her to see a well from which she drew water. Now, it would seem that he caused her to see something that had been there all along. Apparently, the well was quite near to where she was, but she didn't see it until God opened her eyes. He helped her. And just a thought that I see in this, you know, there's a lot of us who have, at one time or the other, felt that we were very near the end. And we thought that death was at the door, and this was the end of the line. But only to find out that we had been blind to the fact that a miracle was at hand. And I believe that that's what the birth of Isaac is all about, because Abraham and Sarah were 190 years respectfully. And again, if you take the Hebrew letters that are equivalent to those values, Kuf and Tzadeh, they spell the word Katz, which means at the end. They're at the end of their life, they think, only to find out that a miracle is right around the corner. Now, verse 20, it says that God was with the lad, that is Ishmael, and he dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. In fact, it says that he dwelt in the wilderness of Paran, and he married an Egyptian. Of course, later on, it is in the wilderness of Paran that Israel is going to believe the evil report of the spies and be forced to wander through the wilderness. And that wilderness they wandered through, some people believe that it's Arabia, where Ishmael lived. Now, in chapter 21, it says that, in verse 22, that Abimelech approached Abraham in order to form a pact with him and with his descendants. And the reason is, he says, "God is with you in all that you do." In other words, he doesn't come to create this pact or this covenant with him because of Abraham's riches or his power, but because we see in your life that God is with you in everything that you do. And so Abraham agrees to enter into this alliance, and he agrees not to deal with Abimelech falsely. Now, it should be noted that Abimelech, who we believe is to be of the Philistines observed this agreement all the way up until the time of Samson. Now, verse 25, Abraham chose this time and this coming together in a covenant to cite a grievance that he had with Abimelech about a well, because it says that Abimelech's servants had violently taken it away. Now, later on, Isaac is going to have a run-in with Avimelech and his servants and his people over wells once again. But Abraham rebukes him, if you will. And what we glean from this is that Abraham, even before the Torah was written down, is demonstrating the Torah's admonition to rebuke your brother, Leviticus 19, verse 17, but not to rebuke him for the sake of rebuking him, but to rebuke him so as not to hate him. In other words, not rebuke for rebuke's sake, but to do things, say things that need to be said in order that you will not harbor bitter feelings toward him. Now, Abraham enters this covenant with him, and he offers Avimelech 7 ewe lambs. The acceptance of this gift was to acknowledge that, in fact, Abraham had dug this well. And Abraham was purchasing the rights to the water of the well. Even as he purchased the cave at Machpelah, he reserved his rights to this well. And the seven ewe lambs was the source of the name Be'er Sheva. Be'er, well, Sheva, or seven, as in seven ewe lambs. But Sheva can also be rendered the word oath, and so Be'er Sheva can also be the well of the oath. And then it tells us that after this covenant had been agreed upon, that Abraham sojourned in the land of the Philistines for many days. Now, in chapter 22, we come to what is perhaps one of the most critical chapters in the Bible. Not the most, but one of the most. And that is, it details the binding of Isaac, or the Akedah. Now, considering Abraham's obedience in many situations, it would seem that the only justification for the test that Abraham had to endure in Genesis 22 is to prove that he would obey God in any circumstance. Tradition tells us that Isaac was 37 years old at the time of the Akedah. I don't know. But the logic behind that is that Sarah was 90 when he was born, and she was 127 when she died. And she dies, it's believed, shortly after this event. Some people say because of this event. But no one knows for sure. However, it's possible that Isaac was a young man rather than a child. Tradition also suggests that this particular event took place on what would become known as Yom Teruah, or the Feast of Trumpets. In fact, this story is part of the reading for Yom Teruah. And Yom Teruah, of course, is associated with the trumpets, or the blowing of the ram's horn, or the shofar. It's a ram that is caught in the thicket by its horns that becomes the substitute sacrifice. But anyway, in verse 1, it says that it came to pass that after these things that God tested Abraham. Now, first of all, the idea of testing is not to suggest that God was tempting him. The idea is not to bring about a failure, but actually to certify the ability to resist failure, to resist temptation. And this was to bring Abraham to the place that God always intended him to be. He had been called out of Babylon, out of the Ur of the Chasdim. He had been called to leave family and relatives. But during the course of this journey, he had shown himself to be weak in areas, and one of those being his desire for self-preservation. But through the journey, he had also shown himself willing to obey without any delay. So anyway, the point is, on the day that Abraham was called out of Babylon, on that day when he was called out of the Ur of the Chasdim, even though he had these issues that he still had to deal with, on that day that he was called from Babylon, God intended to call him to Mount Moriah. And so in this we see the greatest trial that Abraham had to endure, because there is no record of any more tests following this one. It is not about God desiring Isaac's death. That's not the purpose of this test. But I would suggest that the purpose of the test was to bring about Abraham's death to himself. You see, Isaac was the embodiment of the promise that God had made to Abraham. In Isaac is everything. And so God is calling Abraham to give up, or to be willing to give up, everything. In fact, the only one of Abraham's tests that we see in the scripture This is the only one that's actually called a test in the text. In fact, the Hebrew term is nisa, which is a word that also means to prove. Now, it is related to the Hebrew term nes, or banner, also translated ensign, also translated miracle. Another related word is nisayon. Nisayon is trial or tribulation. So the point is this. He is being proven. He is being tested, but not to be destroyed. The idea of the test was to elevate him to where he was supposed to be. He had always intended to call him to the top of Mount Moriah, to be that Abraham, rather than the Abram that was first called out of the Ur of the Chasdim. And so in order to attain the goal, this status, Abraham had to rise above the circumstances. He had to be tested. He had to be proven in order to establish him as a banner, a nes. Because he is the banner, he is the spiritual father that the seed of Abraham looks to as an example. Again, Yeshua said, if you're the children of Abraham, you will do the works of Abraham. And so second only to Messiah, Abraham is this example that we are to look to. Now, it should be noted that there was a miracle that took place as well. And that is the ram is caught in the thicket. But the ram caught in the thicket could not occur if Abraham didn't obey by going up to the top of the mountain. And so the test leads to the miracle. The miracle can't take place unless you're willing to endure the test. So in verse 2 it says, take now your son, your only son, and get into the land of Moriah. And the term take now is chachna, and na is a term that in many places is translated, I pray you. In other words, he is saying, take, please, your son, as if a friend is asking another friend to do this. And he tells him to get into or to go to the land of Moriah. And interestingly, that term in Hebrew is lech lecha, which is what he was told to do at the beginning of his journey. He's told to take him to the land of Moriah. And Moriah is associated with land of teaching. This is where traditionally the school of Shem was. But Moriah, comes from the word more, or is related to the word more or morah, which is the word for teacher. Because this is the place that later on is going to be the site of the Temple Mount. And once he takes him there, he is told to offer him there for a burnt offering, an olah. Actually, it doesn't really say offer as much as it says bring him up for a burnt offering. In fact, the Hebrew phrase is veha elohu. Literally, lift him up. Lift him up for an olah, for a burnt offering. And of course, what comes to mind is, if the Son of Man be lifted up, he will draw all men to him, like a banner, like an ensign. And that's very important that he is called to lift Isaac up upon the altar, because Isaac is, again, the picture of the promised seed. In other words, he doesn't tell him to slaughter Isaac, but to lift him up upon the altar. Now, in verse 3, it says that Abraham rose early in the morning, and he went to the place of which God spoke. And again, Abraham does not hesitate to obey God's command, but he saddles his donkey, he himself cleaves the wood, and then he gets his servants, he gets Isaac, and he begins to go on this journey. Now, why does he take the two servants? It's not explained, but something very interesting happens that involves those two servants. Now, as we continue on into verse 4, it says that on the third day, Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. Now, on the third day, Abraham sees the goal, and this is what prompted him to say to the servants in verse 5, you stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go yonder to worship, and we will come back to you. What was it that he saw that made him so confident that both he and Isaac would return? Why was he so confident that God would provide himself the lamb for a burnt offering? Notice what the writer of Hebrews has to say about this in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, "In Isaac your seed shall be called," concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. In other words, Abraham, because he believed God, and he believed that it would be through Isaac that he, Abraham, would be the father of many nations, he concluded that if he was expected to take Isaac's life, then God would be obligated to raise up Isaac from the dead. And so the promised seed becomes a picture of the one who was raised from the dead. And Abraham is thinking this on the third day. Now, note what Yeshua had to say concerning Abraham in John chapter 8, verse 56. "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and was glad." Then the Jews said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?" Yeshua said to them, "Most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." In this text, we see that Yeshua acknowledges that Abraham saw my day. When did Abraham see his day? Was it possibly as he made his way to Mount Moriah? Because Abraham did see something, because he later named the mountain Yahweh Yireh, which is to say, Yahweh, he will see to it, or Yahweh will be seen. But the point is, he saw something. Yeshua says, "He saw my day." Now, the Hebrew term, the place, is Hamakom. And Hamakom is also a title that is ascribed to God, because he is in every place, thus he is the place. Psalm 139:8 says, "If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there." In other words, there is no place that I can go that he isn't already there. So he's not just in a place, he's in every place, he is the place. So again, Hamakom is a word, yes, but it's also a title that is ascribed to God. Now, the Hebrew word that is translated afar off, or in the distance, he saw the place afar off, is merachok. And merachok is a word that, depending on the context, can be afar off in the distance of space, like from me to the door or what have you, or it can be afar off in the distance of time. So then, on the surface, it says that he lifted up his eyes on the third day and he saw the place afar off. He saw the particular place in the distance that he was supposed to take Isaac to. But it also hints that he saw the Lord in the distance of time. And it was on the third day that he did this. And Yeshua says that Abraham saw my day. Abraham is confident that God will provide himself a lamb when it's a ram caught in the thicket and not a lamb. He's confident when he tells his servants that he and Isaac are going to be returning to them. And all this occurred on the third day and in the place that would be called Yahweh Yireh. Yahweh, he will see to it. What would he see to? That a lamb is provided for the burnt offering. Yeshua said, "Abraham saw my day. He rejoiced when he saw my day." Even the rabbis determined that the spirit of prophecy came upon him and revealed things to him, and that he knew things that he was not telling anybody else. And it is my firm belief that he knew that God would provide himself a lamb because he saw his day. It was the third day. Now in verse 6, it says that Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac. The wood, that phrase, is et etzi. Et is just a word that serves as a sign of the direct object. But etzi, that is translated the wood, is actually from the word tree. So it could be argued that he laid the tree upon Isaac. And then Isaac, the promised seed, carries the tree to the top of the mountain to be lifted up upon the altar to be a sacrifice. In verse 9, it says that Abraham built the altar there, and he bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar. Now, if Isaac was an adult, why did he have to be bound? The reason given is that at the last moment he might flinch, and if he flinched, there would be some very distasteful results. And so Isaac understood by this time that he was the sacrifice and allowed himself to be bound without resisting his father. So Isaac is having to surrender himself completely as well, and yet this is a test for Abraham. At least that's what the record says. It doesn't say it's a test for Isaac. It's a test for Abraham. In Isaac, Abraham saw the covenant. He saw the promise, the mission that he was given. And as far as he's concerned, the very purpose of creation, because the purpose of creation was that the Creator would have a people that he could coexist with, dwell in their midst. That people was to be Israel, and Israel comes into existence through Abraham, through Isaac, and then later Jacob, who is Israel. And so Isaac represents everything. Isaac represents Abraham's life. And even though he had pleaded on the account of Sodom and the cities of the plain, for Isaac, he does not utter one word. And is it possible he doesn't do this because that would be construed as him pleading for himself when God was calling him to self-denial? You see, it already shown that he was very prone to self-preservation. And so now perhaps the test is, Abraham, are you willing to die to you 100% completely? And so in verse 10, most likely with tears in his eyes, Abraham took the knife to slay his son. Now, in every sense except physically, Abraham did slay Isaac, and he did burn his remains. Even though the ram was eventually offered instead of Isaac, Isaac was obedient and Abraham was obedient. Abraham was obedient to bring him to the top of the mountain to offer him there. Isaac was obedient as the offering when he ascended the altar and when he descended from it. So the ram that's burnt in his place is a reminder of Abraham's obedience to God and Isaac's willingness to become the sacrifice. So this action on the part of Abraham and Isaac, the rabbis say, left a very strong spiritual imprint on Mount Moriah. And so the temple offerings that occurred there later were a continuation of what started here with Abraham and with Isaac. Because willing to die to one's self for the sake of God's will, that's actually what those offerings represent. And so the rabbis declare that Isaac became a living sacrifice, sanctified, and because of that, he could not leave the land. Now, in Romans chapter 12, verse 1, Paul says that, "I beseech you therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service." Now, in verse 11, it says that the angel of the Lord called unto him, "Abraham, Abraham, don't hurt the lad." Now, tradition says that the voice came from the place there on Mount Moriah where the ark would later rest, from between the two cherubim. And the voice said to him, "I know that you are a God-fearing man because you have not withheld your only son from me." In other words, signifying that Abraham feared God more than anything and would not keep anything from him. But again, we see that God didn't want Isaac's death. He wanted Abraham to die to himself. And so he looks, and there, caught in the thicket by its horns, is the ram, and he offered that instead. And in verse 14, he called the place Yahweh Yireh, in the mount of the Lord, or in the mount where the Lord is seen, or Yahweh, he will see to it. Now, we've mentioned this before, but the original name given to Jerusalem was Shalem, and that comes from a word that means to be whole, to be complete. And we suppose that this name came by Shem. But Abraham called it Yireh, and Yireh means he will see to it. And so we believe that, and it's taught that, Jerusalem, or Yerushalayim, is derived from these two words, Yerushalem, which is to say, the Lord, He will see to it that everything is whole and complete. He will provide Himself a lamb. In verse 16, it says, by myself I swear, because you have done this, which is the same as saying, as I live, because you have done this. He then reaffirms the covenant with Abraham and with his seed. And he tells him that your descendants are going to possess the gate of his enemies. In other words, your descendants will overcome their enemies. Now, Yeshua, later on, he followed up on this in Matthew 16, verse 18. He tells us that on this rock I will build my congregation, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. And if the gates of Hades aren't going to prevail against it, that means that his people are going to possess the gates of our enemies, namely the gates of Hades. In verse 19, after all this has happened, it says, so Abraham returned to his young men, and he dwelt at Beersheba. And he returned with Isaac, the one who was dead, but is now alive. Now, rabbinical commentary states this concerning this binding of Isaac. It says, when the sword reached Isaac's neck, his soul left him. When God's voice came from heaven, between the two cherubim, telling Abraham not to harm him, his soul returned to his body. And Isaac experienced the resuscitation of the dead and said, blessed are you, Lord, who makes the dead live. So in other words, according to rabbinical commentary, Isaac died, but Isaac was resurrected. According to the Vilna Gaon, the second blessing of the Shmoneh Esrei that says, who makes the dead live, is actually referring to Isaac. And keeping in mind, Isaac is the promised seed who took the tree on the hill up the mountain to be lifted up and to ascend the altar to be the sacrifice. But, according to rabbinical belief, died and was resurrected. And when did this occur? It was on the third day that Abraham lifted up his eyes and he saw Hamakom Merakok. He saw the place afar off, or he saw the Lord in the distance of time. And so finally, this portion mentions that Abraham's brother Nahor has been given children. And in verse 23, it specifically says that Bethuel begot Rebekah. Rebekah, of course, is going to be his future daughter-in-law. And through this union that comes between Rebekah and Isaac, we're going to see the birth of Israel.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.